Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Happy fall. It's lovely outside. Welcome to the kitchen. Here we are in the KHOI studios. And we are a community radio station. We are put together by people that love to volunteer, love to share opinions,
and love to give to their community.
Yes, and here is one of them.
Okay, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in lovely Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we have a special guest, and we are glad to have him. We have Martin Prechtel with us today. He's a leading thinker, writer, and teacher in the search for the indigenous soul in all people. Martin Prechtel is a dedicated student of eloquence, history, language, and an ongoing fresh approach. He is an author, a prolific author, and his latest book is called The Smell of Rain on Dust.
I love that title.
Grief and Praise. Grief and Praise. He'll talk about that. He also has written books with titles like Secrets of the Talking Jaguar, Long Life, Honey in the Heart, The Disobedience of the Daughter of the Sun, Stealing Benefacto's Roses, and The Unlikely Peace at Chuchumakik. And I've just finished that book. So we've got lots to talk about. And another thing. He is going to be here in Ames.
He's going to be here in Ames next week, Tuesday, October 22nd, 7 p.m., in the library.
Yes, Tuesday, October 27th, in the Ames Public Library. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, Martin.
Hello, Martin.
I guess it's noon over there with the old guys, but yeah.
Yeah, 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 it is. Yes.
Hello.
It's lunchtime.
We are glad to have you with us.
So Martin is in New Mexico, and we're trying this phone interview, which is a new technique for us. So
it probably isn't for Martin, but we're just all thrilled to have this thing. Martin, you're home. You are native to New Mexico now, but you've also lived in Guatemala. Tell us a little about yourself and your life's journey so far and what you have learned.
Good Lord. Okay. Well, we have a couple of days. I've learned a lot. I was actually born in a car on my way somewhere. My mother's people were Canadian Indians, and they moved to, believe it or not, to Michigan to get warm. And I guess it wasn't as warm as they thought. Anyway, she married my father after World War II, and he didn't want anything more to do with wars because he'd been a flyer. And he became a paleontologist, moved to Wyoming, and then my mother, saying like her ancestors before, it's too cold up here, let's go somewhere where it's warm, went to New Mexico, and lo and behold, it wasn't warm either. It was 18 below in the winter like it is here every winter. But she stayed and got a job on a Native American Indian reservation, being an Indian herself. And so I grew up in a little, well, it wasn't so little, a large pueblo here in New Mexico, and grew up in an America which turned out, and which I didn't know, to be a little different than the rest of America. So by the time I was 16, you know, I had to go see the world, and I got married, and it was a failure and so forth. My mother passed away at a very young age, fighting for Native American educational rights and stuff to keep from being beaten in the schools for not speaking English and all that. And most of the people I grew up did not speak English, and
which
they never looked
Pueblo
upon it.
Which Pueblo did you grow up on, Martin?
We're not allowed to tell you, but it's between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And,
okay.
Yeah, they don't like being on the radio, but they're very, very close, very antique people. There's a lot of Pueblos. There's 19 of them, and I was in one of them. Anyway, I ended up in Guatemala because when my mother passed away at the age of 42, fighting for these rights and actually accomplishing it that very year, she mysteriously died. I was very bitter about it. And I headed out on the road and just was heading out, you know, and those were the old, you know, 1971, 72, something like that. And I ended up going south to Mexico, which right here is very logical and very easy in those days. And I just kept drifting, and I wrote a whole book on it. As a matter of fact, I've written three books on it. And I ended up in Guatemala, not actually planning to stay in Guatemala or even go to Guatemala, to be honest. But when I got there, I ended up being part of a very beautiful place called Santiago Atitlán, which is Tzotzil Mayan people, a very antique people living there, as most of the 11 million Mayans of Guatemala are. And huge Native American country, tiny little country with a huge Native American population, living very antique ways. And so I ended up being what you might say the grunt or work pony for this very powerful Native healer and just human being named Nicolas Chiviliu Takashoy. I married into the village, and then I lived there for a long time. Well, for me as a young man, it was a long time. And then in about 1979, 1980, things started heating up with war there.
Oh, yeah, very difficult time.
1980 was really bad. Mm. And so I wasn't planning on leaving, even though the old man before he died said, go, you got to get out of here, they're going to kill you. And so after lots of, you know, almost getting killed and realizing a lot of other people would get killed.
For our audience, I just want to remind everybody that there was practically an indigenous genocide in Guatemala in that period.
It was 180,000 people died in 4 years.
Major.
Our village alone, 1,900.
Very sad. And this is very contemporary, really. It was in the...
I was in the 80s, and then, you know, it's not exactly over.
No.
But the worst of it was over. So anyway, I came back to the States with the family I had then. It was a very, very hard time, and on it goes. But, you know, how things are, I grew up, you know, silversmithing and doing all these, you know, normal New Mexico things, raising livestock and so forth and farming a little bit. And so to raise family, you know, I ended up mysteriously just by, it's a long story, so I didn't want to take up all your time on the show. I know you've got a lot to talk about.
Well, that's right.
I ended up, you know, teaching actually in Minnesota and in California with crazy old poet Robert Bly in these men's conferences, which I was terrified of going to because I couldn't imagine being in the woods with 150 white guys reading Rumi and beating drums and all that. But, you know, they were paying good, so I read. And Robert and I became very good friends, and I actually liked what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the few things I was able to walk out of Guatemala with in my hands, you know, was some seeds, very, very special seeds of birth from the village.
Mm.
And I was so impressed with all these guys and what they were doing. There was the mayor of San Francisco, and this Obama fellow was there, you know, and there's all these bigwigs. They were doing a leaders' conference. And there's little old Martin there, you know, doing his thing about talking about all these things that I talk about. And at the end, the biggest gift I could possibly give them is I gave all my seeds away, which, by the way, is not a good idea. Don't do that. If you've got seeds, don't give them all away. If you're going to give some away, that's all right, but don't give them all away. So I gave them all away like an idiot, and they took off with them. Most people didn't understand what they were, and a few did. And there was this one little funny guy who started growing them. And he came back years later, a strange little man's name, I can't even remember. They just called him Wiz. That was his nickname. And he brought these seeds back, and they did not look like anything I'd ever given away in my life. They'd been so outcrossed with every kind of sweet corn and every, probably all from Iowa, you know. And I, you know, I was sad about it. But I started giving them away at all my workshops, so I started teaching for a living. And then about, 2002 or three. I said, you know, I was remarried. My Indian wife had gone back to Guatemala. My children in their 30s. They're all off doing their thing. And so I decided, you know, after 90 flights a year, round-trip flights a year, that I was never at home in New Mexico. I loved so much. So I said, maybe I'll start a school, which I'd always had a really bad feeling about. But and maybe somebody will come, and maybe they won't. But if they do, they'll save us a little bit of running around in this, all these TSA places. And so I did it, and lo and behold, 250 people showed up, and it's been going now for 12, 13 years. And so here I am in New Mexico, living on my ranch and our two ranches, and raising animals and writing these funny little books and going around. And because I get a new book, I finally going out again, and, you know, going around saying hi to the folks. So,
does that make you a farmer, really?
Well, I don't know. A rancher, probably, close. I mean, we are not really farming in the sense for money. We're not into production. Mm-hmm. We're into making food. And it's, you know, meats and all of the vegetables, and I grow grain. I can't eat wheat myself, and or even oats or even barley, even though I love them all. They make me very ill. I got this Indian blood of mine, so I grow a type of corn, two types, actually. Well, actually, I grow six types, but two main types are really, really ancient from my upbringing. And as a matter of fact, that's where I was a little late. We were just hanging at the last.
So are you growing Pueblo corn, or are you growing
white? Yeah, it's Pueblo corn, really ancient Pueblo corn. The cultures here don't just grow corn, you know. There's no such thing as, like, Iowa corn or Deck corn, any of that. We don't just do that. It's just a whole other different kinds of corns, yeah.
Do they have names or colors?
Yeah,
or?
Mm-hmm, they all have names, yeah. This one is called Concho. The local name for it is Concho or Tocatoth, and which means the woman made a white shell. It's a kind of ivory-looking corn. And then the other one, a lot of people like to call it a blue corn, but it's not the blue corn of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually probably closer to a deep burgundy. And it has little throwbacks to some kinds of popcorn and wrapped, you know, pod corns. But extremely easy to use, extremely easy to digest. And I've only one other guy getting it to. I'm the only guy who has it right now because it's gone extinct where I grew up. But they're growing a variety of it still. So I've been, you know, seeds, how they go. The seeds don't really preserve too well unless you keep growing them. You know, you can stick them in the seed bank, but, you know, they've only got a life of so long. They only, like culture, it has to be constantly replanted, relearned, understood, and constantly loved and taken care of and eaten by the people. Otherwise, they atrophy, just like the culture atrophies. So that's what that book, you know, as you just read, Then Like a Piece of Kuchimukiku, is all about.
Mm-hmm.
I have some corn from there, too, but that's the corn I gave away. I was never planning on, you know, that corn that came from Titlang was never a corn that was used by the people for eating, you know. It's hard for modern people to remember this, but a lot of ancient peoples grew different kinds of plants ceremonially.
Mm-hmm.
And this plant is for when you die and for when you're born. And the army had burnt all the corn and killed everybody that was growing it, and it was just terrible. But there was a little tiny bit this one guy had kept alive, and so when I left the last time I was in the country before, you know, they were hunting me down again, I had a little tiny bit, which I kind of smuggled into the States between my toes and other places we won't mention on the air, but... And did take it in, and just, I didn't replant it. And can you believe it? Me, of all guys, didn't replant it. I just came looking at it like it was Buddha or Jesus or something. And it was the last thing I had from the village. So when I gave it away, it was so amazing to see that when it came back, you know, it was obviously crossed out. And it was no longer, it didn't look nothing like anything I'd ever seen from the village. But after about 8 years, it starts showing up again. There was a little old lady down in, well, she wasn't that old, but, I mean, we'd like to call her a little old lady. That goat lady from Carmel, California, was planting all these multicolored crazy corns that we give away every time I'd come through town. And all of a sudden, it started making this one variety of corn. One variety of corn. She couldn't get it out. It was just the same one that I took from Atitlan, as far as we were concerned, and look, and everything else. And independently, about 700 miles away, there was another lady who I didn't know too well, but she brought me a great big old sack of the same thing was happening to her. And then there was a guy who I'd given the corn away to when I first came back, did that conference in Mendocino with Robert Bly, and he had grown it in Moab without any, and this guy was like a hermit, you know, I can't even explain to you.
Mm-hmm.
He never talked to another human being, way on the desert, and he'd grow this stuff up in them canyons. And he killed himself. He got very, very ill from some sort of sickness. Put all the seed corn in a paper bag, gave it to his brother, and wrote me this beautiful love letter on the back.
Oh.
And then put and offed himself. And then the man, he brought it to my school, and I opened it up, and I saw the one corn that this lady had been, the seeds that this one lady had been growing, the seeds that this boy had been growing, and the seeds that this other lady had been growing. And I couldn't tell them apart. And I did the most insane thing is I mixed them all up together again, gave them out to everybody so I didn't have any more, and they're still growing them, and they're still coming back. So I just had this enormous feeling of hope for human culture, the human spirit, and what's holy in seeds is that even GMOs and all this other stuff that everybody's so proud of and other people are so terrified of, but anyway, everybody thinks they're so big and powerful in the earth, and they don't even think nature is anything except their minion. That all of a sudden there's something bigger at work, you know, inside the seeds than even human beings can control. So that gave me
Thank
so much
heavens,
hope.
Yeah. Good.
And I had the same thing happen with horses, which I'm not going to talk about because you guys are seed guys. But yeah. Sorry about that. I know you're cooks and you're farmers. We're supposed to be talking about my new book. But I love that old book, and I love that you love it. So
oh, it's wonderful.
It's doing me so good to hear that.
Like I mentioned, your new book is called The Smell of Rain on Dust. It's about grief and praise. When I read it, I kept referring to it as grief and joy. We need both.
Yeah,
the idea of grief,
heaven knows the what you went through in Guatemala with Santiago Atitlan people. That's a huge cause for grief. But are there things that we should grieve here in the United States? Are there things that
the
we should
United
grieve?
The United States should be grieved.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree.
It's a mess.
I'm
it's
terrified of the future.
Especially with the ground and the farms and all that. These wonderful old-time people have been trying to keep these things alive. And, you know, I mean, I'm not a big advocate of production farming, but, you know, I mean, the new organic movements, a lot of them are not that much better than some of the other ones, but they are better.
They're better than nothing.
Better than nothing. But the organic gardeners and the people who are doing it on a homestead level, those are my heroes, because heroines, because, you know, they're, you just, well, first of all, if you see any of these people, you know, they're healthy looking. I mean, you know, they look beautiful because, you know, they're eating real food. And this terrible thing that people have been talked into eating is not the food's fault, but the people's fault for you know, making that business out of it. So now you've got corporations, you know, who are you know, applying for some sort of victim status because there's some, you know, drained out minority, so that they can keep selling everybody all of this stuff that's killing the kids and all the people. It's terrible. So I think that there's an amazing, I mean, if you just go into the Native American thing, I mean, this is going to be grief from here to forever, but all of the plants, too, and the animals and the ecosystems and all of the farms themselves, I mean, there's it's just big walking tears. So I think that the great hope is that inside people there's this kind of spiritual DNA, which I just kind of coined as the indigenous soul, that knows how to be a person, knows how to grow things, knows how to grieve. The thing about grief, you know, you speak to Northern Europeans about grief and everybody starts running. You know, grief or death, don't mention
exactly.
That on there.
Can't,
that's
can't talk about those
the seven
things.
Bad words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, kiss of death, ah! Everybody goes. But you see, when I came back from Guatemala, I came back from a culture that was a seed culture, and I watched it go down the tubes and get killed, literally, with mm-hmm. military action, most of which was supported by the North. And not all, but most. And when I got to the country of the United States, back to the United States, I was, you know, you're talking about grief. It's just grief, 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 grief. But the grief itself was not an issue. It was the loss and no place to put it. Back in the old village, grief was actually the medicine, and grief eventually turned to praise and turned to, the, as you call it, joy. It's more like ecstasy. Of praising, having been given enough life to have loved enough, to have lost, in order to praise, to make more life again.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would go to these funerals of people I knew, there would be no mention of the dead person, you know, barely, and they start talking about their NASDAQ and their stock market things, anything to avoid, you know, talking about loss or feeling any emotion whatsoever. I was like, wow, this is really weird, you know, I never noticed this.
So I would start doing my little rituals,
and they would actually attack me. And so I thought, you know what? Grief turns to violence if it doesn't turn to praise. So I started looking at people, and I said, the people, you see somebody in the hospital that's just lost a limb, has had it amputated, and all of a sudden they're praising life, and they're praising the doctors, and they're praising all these people. And then you see all these people that have everything, and they're not praising anything. They're always worried about what they ain't got. So I started thinking, you know what? I bet it's a formula. I bet it's some sort of syllogism that people who cannot praise are not going to be very good at grief, and people who are not very good at grief have never been taught to praise as children. So I started looking at that, and, you know, it was not a huge discovery for me, but I started talking about it, and somebody bootlegged the tape of me doing it once in Minneapolis, right where I'm going there, a couple weeks, the exact same place. Somebody stole it out of the sound machine of the DAT.
Well, they must have needed it, Martin.
And they bootlegged it, and they sold it. And then they sent one to me later. Somebody didn't know it was me, and they said, you know what? This guy talks a lot like you. I said, it is me.
It's like that corn. It comes right back to you.
It's so funny. And it was a terrible tape. I tell you what, it was awful. But everybody loved it. I got so many love letters from places you wouldn't believe. One of them was Iowa. Other one, Nebraska. Another one, Russia. Other places in India and South Africa. I couldn't believe all these people loved what I was saying. So eventually I wrote the book about it, which is not the same as the tape. I hope it's better. But anyway, sorry, I got off the subject there.
Lana needs to do a little station break.
Surely.
Oh, then here we go. It's The Donna Lana Kitchen. You are listening to KHOI FM 89.1. You can find out more about this fine radio station at khoifm.org. Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking to Martin Prechtel. He will be in Ames next week on October 27th. And we're talking a bit about his new book called The Smell of Rain on Dust. It's about grief and praise. But he also, actually it's all connected. Everything is connected, of course. He also has an interest and has a lot to say about farming, seeds, the web of life that connects us all.
The indigenous worldview.
Yes.
And we're all indigenous. We just have to dig back a little bit more deeply.
Right. There's a man named Wes Jackson that has the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, and he's busy studying the prairie ecosystem and what's good and what lasts in that system. And he often says we all have to learn to be native to a place. And that may be a pretty long, long process for us. But Martin, as far as you're concerned, a long, long process is good because we have not just our lifetime, but we have the lifetime of everything that's connected to us, right?
Our ancestors.
At least.
At least. There you go.
At least, yeah. The thing is, well, where I come from, humans are not the center of attention, or nor are they the only thing that matters. The people, native people where I come from in both places where I was raised and also where I used to live in Guatemala, they really actually don't see humans as people. They see them as part of the natural world. Individual humans have souls, but these are not souls like, Judeo-Christian souls. These are organic souls. They're like animal, plants, winds, I guess you would call environmental souls. Some person might be this part of the world, and this other person might be that part of the world. While they look like a human being, animal type of being to some people, to like shaman or any sort of native doctor, or I have to tell you, all of the farmers themselves, they relate to the world as all of these different things. So when you look at a village, you actually see the entire natural world standing out there. You don't just see all these ladies and men and little kids. So when you're planting seeds, you're actually holding a handful of memories that connect you from one time that you're not seeing at this time to another time that you will not see, or if you will see, you won't see it in the form you are. And so when the people are going to go plant those seeds, they have grief. They say to the seed, they say, They have a little special place. Imagine modern people call it an altar of sorts, and they talk to the seeds, they talk to the plants, and they say, "Are you willing to die for the appearance of human culture?" And that's literally what they say to these seeds, and then they weep about the fact that something has to die in order to feed you. In other words, nothing can feed a human being unless it's being harvested, cut, or going in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So if that majesty of generosity is not honored by the human beings, then they're just taking in some sort of strange, unfortunate way. So when they do plant the seeds and they do get permission from the seeds, as they consider through dreams, then when the plant sprouts up, God willing, I know in Iowa you put a corn in there and it sprouts the next day, but, you know, some other places it takes more than a day. And boop, and when it comes up, everybody just goes to their knees and they say, "Ah, it's good. Utskinsachi, utskinsawachumestik." They say, "It's good to see your face again. Good to feel your breath again, Mother." Because the idea is that dawn, when the sun comes up and when a sprout comes up, it's one and the same thing. It's not cute to them, and it's not, you know, something that's a metaphor. It's a very, very literal returning of life to the people because they see their lives as parallel with all of the plants.
Well, you know, even in Iowa, when the seeds sprout, I think everybody has a kind of inner rejoicing.
Well, it'd be great if they had an outer one.
<That's>
if everybody just jumped up and down or got drunk or something, rolled around the field, that would be great. Instead of, I like inner, you know. They're going to bust, you know, you start saying something. Sing a song or something.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
At least we can smile, you know. The Iowans, we can manage.
Yeah, you could smile.
Smile,
her,
right? Martin.
Iowans are better than Minnesotans, man. I tell you what. Holy, I won't get into it. But.
In the worldview, what kind of, talk about soil.
Yeah, well, soil is everything.
Yeah.
Soil is everything. Air and soil, you know, and water. Well, the word in Mayan for what you would call soil is called uliev. And uliev means everything that ever used to exist.
Oh.
In other words, anything that grows or that we eat ourselves are rooted in, just physically, anybody go outside, look, you're standing on the earth, is that everything that used to be when it composts or made into humus at its death is giving life to the next set of present time. So the word for soil is not only where everything is rooted in, but is the actual physical representation and substance of everything that ever was. So it's so holy. I mean, I can't even begin to say.
And how do the Guatemalans care for their soil particularly?
Okay, well, first of all, we got to distinguish the Guatemalans from the Mayans, because Guatemala is a national culture like the United States, and I'm not so sure Guatemalan culture is so great with the soil either.
Oh.
But the Indians... themselves, traditionally, you know, they've been talked in, a lot of them have been talked into all sorts of nefarious things with chemicals and so on. But traditionally speaking, everything that you have, everything that that dies in the house that's in the old days was all organic. There's no such thing as plastic. I mean, your baskets, everything goes back to the fields. They have rules for not cutting down trees. It's a very forested country, by the way, and it's very hilly. And you don't have that great flat place like you have in Iowa where it's rolling hills where you can just run a tractor. Everything's either up or down, you know. It's volcanic. So everything has to be hauled out or in. And so what happens is you have all the old laws about not cutting certain trees at the certain corners of certain plants and certain places. The idea is that you make your houses exactly the same way you make your fields. And a lot of people squint their eyes and say, "Well, how would you do that?" You know, well, what they did in the old days, which, by the way, is going extinct now because of all of the AID guys and everybody's pushed all this other kind of way of being. But traditionally speaking, the idea is that a man would, upon coming of age, make a rope out of a certain plant, which is called, you know, I think in English they call it a century plant, a kind of maguey. And this is from the distance from where his heart is to the tip of his left finger times 13, which is the integer used as a common denominator in their calendar. And that distance that runs 13th of those which are called brass, ha, is the distance, a common denominator used in order to build their houses and huts. It's also the same exact distance between the corners of how much land a man can hoe in a day to grow whatever plants he's planning to grow in a set field. And on those corners are where the trees are to be left alive. So basically, when they're farming the house of the holy. And when they come to the house, all the foodstuffs that come in the house are relinquished from the men and given to the women, and then the women are taking care of the food of the holy inside their own house. And so the house itself is the universe, the field is the universe, and everybody is a participant in a great universe kind of spirituality. Modern people say, oh, what good does that do the earth? That doesn't do the earth any good. You know, we need just this, that, and the other, and science, and science, and science. And, of course, they go home depressed, take their pharmaceuticals, and go to the field again. But the point is that in the process of doing that, there's an old agreement, spiritual agreement with the land. A certain land, if you take it from the wild, you have to give a certain amount of already used land back to the wild and never touch it again. So there was this old... it's a little different than feral, and a little different than leaving a couple of years between plantings.
Not like the fallow system.
This no is fallow system.
Giving it back.
It's just giving it back, and the same goes for the ocean. Not a popular modern idea, where you just get more and more and more territory, and instead of building up the territory and staying good with it. And so that depends, of course, on your population and everything. And I remember when I was there living in Guatemala, I was a leader at one point, and the AID guys would come down and try to get all the Indians into their system, because they say, what they got to do is get on a monetary system, get off the subsistence farming thing, get away from homestead farming so that they make money. So we want them to farm commercial avocados for, a big food chain. And none of the Indians would do it. They said, well, what are we going to do with, that many avocados and not enough this food, this food, this food, this food, this food. So they just kept going. And so the guy said, well, how are we going to get them to do it? I said, well, we can't manipulate the people to do something that's stupid. I'm not going to do it. And they said, they were really mad at me. And I said, I tell you what, this is my idea. If you think it's a good idea, why don't you rent some land from some of these Indian guys? And you go out there and you plant it. And after 10 years, if it looks like a good idea, I'm sure everybody else is going to want to help. And so they got mad and stomped off.
No, they didn't want to take 10 years to do it, I'm sure.
They didn't want to take 10 days to do it. They didn't want someone else to do it.
Well, man does not live by avocado alone.
Mm-mm. Although it's not a bad one, but, right. Still, humans don't live by one thing alone. Nothing lives by one thing alone.
Yeah.
No, the soil is everything, my friends. I don't even have nowhere to begin to talk about that. It's just an amazing... See, I live in the desert. Well, I imagine you would consider it a desert. We think it's a beautiful land, but it's a totally different way of soil and everything. And yet we're growing all sorts of wonderful, beautiful things here, and people can't believe it, And I grew up with that, and I have so much spiritual relationship with it and all of the animals. And we also I'm a meat eater, and so we grow all our own meats, all our own beefs and all our own goats and sheep and what have you. And chicken and all of these things. But almost all of what we feed them is sprouted things that we grow ourselves. And it's not the idea that a person can be independent, which is the other thing, the real big American idea is that I'm, all by myself. I'm a nuclear family. Instead of needing one another.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing of trying to do something good for the earth isn't possible by a single human being. But single human beings have to try to begin, and they're the ones always suffering so heavily from so much effort they put into it. But it's an interrelationship, and all of these different markets and stuff. It's just, it could work out really. I had all these big plans, every little town had a cow and a family that raises this, and these guys raise that. And also there's this image of farmers being sort of like these slugs or these rubes from the country, whereas in Guatemala, in the village, they call all the hierarchy of spiritually advanced people, they call them the great group of the farmers. They weren't called farmers because they were just all farmers, which they were, but because farming was the most spiritual, awake, and version of poetry and understanding and learning that could be had among those people. Whereas in modern times, the farming has gone corporate, but it comes from this whole idea of, you got these serfs in the field, and then you got these poor guys with their 40 acres trying to make it who can't pay the bank.
Well, I have to say, here in Iowa, we still have some vestiges of feeling that farmers are really, really important and creative beings, and the farmer poet, and how,
absolutely.
There's still some of that here,
sure.
Because we have a lot of real farmers.
Well,
that's
actually,
right.
Yeah, what a bit of hope here in Iowa is that the local food movement is just coming, budding, and
brilliant.
There are younger people that actually really truly want to farm for a living, and this sort of energy, and again, getting land is really hard, getting started is really hard.
That's the problem right there.
Yeah, but the but the influence of new people with new ideas, and really they do seem to have a love for things. And we're talking about love for our, as we talk to each other, we realize that we can build this sort of thing. It's not, I wouldn't say that it's over all of the farmers in Iowa, but there's a little pocket, and it's a good
tribe. And there are some, we do have some wise older farmers who have been caring for their land rather
valiantly.
Those
are the ones I love too, you know.
Yep.
Amazing people too. We're the same here with all the old ranchers and stuff. They love what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I'm going around, because people are always saying to me, oh, this is all dead and this is all gone. No, you know, those people are there. They're
just
not represented, you know.
Absolutely.
So I'll go out there and make as much noise as I can and hope that people have the courage to come out of the woodwork.
Exactly. And that's we have some longtime organic farmers in Iowa who very carefully tend their fields, completely surrounded by their neighbors whom they care about, who are growing in completely different ways. But we still have some very intelligent, caring farmers here.
Well, I tell you, you got the most beautiful land there. I tell you what, I've been through it.
I
had a bunch of Mayans visiting me in New Mexico about, I must have been about 1990 or something. And I took them on a little mini tour around different places. They were terrified of Texas. It was so flat. They had never seen anything without mountains. But when we got to Iowa, they just said, wow, these people are in heaven. Look at those cornfields. Because the Mayans, you know, they plant everything by hand. They didn't have any tractors or anything. And they saw these fields and this black dirt, you know, and they went for miles and miles and pigs everywhere. And I'm like, and there was, oh, my, they just couldn't believe it. They went home and told everybody they'd been to heaven.
Well, there is a lot here worth taking better care of, I have to
say.
Yeah,
yeah. Definitely. Well, I'm not the authority, but I'm a rabble-rouser, so. Yeah.
Oh, good. One thing I have enjoyed, Martine, about reading your books, I have to mention here that you write the longest sentences I have ever, ever encountered. But I love to read, and I realize that each of your sentences has so much in it. So I just kind of dance through each page. It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
We suspect there's some oral tradition at work here, Martine.
Yeah, that's what it is. No, I don't know if you ever read a book called Oklahanali. It's a wonderful book by Ari Lafferty from Oklahoma, written about the Choctaw people from Mississippi who were, you know, sent to Oklahoma. And he was talking about how there was no punctuation and how they would speak in these great big giant long sentences. Well, where I grew up, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to transfer that into English, make English carry a non-English idea, you know. But my newest book, I have to say, has some short sentences in it. So,
good for
you. I mean, English used to have long sentences. You could read Dickens or Pope or any of those guys. Maybe it's three-page sentences, you know. I'm not the only one, but I'm just one of the newer ones. I know, I understand. Also, this new book, you can't hurt anybody with it. The old ones are so big, if you threw it at somebody, it hurt them. You know, this one, you could throw it, they wouldn't even know you hit them with it.
That's a very thoughtful thing when you could publish a book. I never thought of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't hold the door open with it, though.
Again, this importance of language, saying things beautifully is important. There's You tell stories well, and there are stories of people, of the indigenous people that you, well, your friends and neighbors that you live with and the people that you have lived with. Some of the stories are absolutely fantastic. Can you give me the name of, I can't pronounce the name of the Mayan tribe you lived with. It starts with a T.
Tutuhil,
got it.
You know what it means the tassel on the corn plant.
Oh!
Corn tassel people.
The corn tassel people. Well, that makes sense.
And
you write about the fact that the seeds do connect them, and the seeds, they are the seeds, and passing from generation to generation. There's a little bit you talk about the Mayan calendar and how that is based on not really moon and stars and a mathematical sort of thing, but it's about cycles. It's about sacred time and sacred seeds. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's been, you know, there's been so much written about Mayans, the word Mayan being a problem because there's so many types of Mayans.
Yeah.
And we're in the Highland Mayans now, we're talking about you and I. And they're always talking about the Mayan calendar as a written down thing. The Mayan calendar was never written down by any Mayans whatsoever. They were Mayan almanacs that referred to the calendar, but the calendar was always a sack of seeds. It was a sack, and the regular, you know, run-of-the-mill, you know, Joe Sixpack person had a sack of corn seeds. But the great diviners, they used a calendar made out of tzachtel seeds, which is a type of Erythrina corallandrum. It's a rather poisonous tree, but an amazing plant that goes exactly in time according to its flowering, the time it leaves, the time it puts out its beans. And so the entire way of understanding time is actually from an organic plant. The plant actually grows time, if you can dig that. And so in the language, they speak about time in terms of plant growth. So it's really amazing. Well, I mean, I wrote the whole section on that. There's a couple of people who are liking it.
Well, we can relate to that in Iowa. Yeah. It is like corn harvest time now.
Yeah. The thing is, this plant, whether there's any corn, whether there's anything, and the weirdest thing about this plant is you can take a cutting of it and stick it down that Iowa soil. It'll take over the whole state, I tell you what. And then no matter what altitude it's in, it grows a different way. It used to blow my mind. I would see it growing in the deep thicket jungles, which I didn't live in. You know, you visit those, it's really hot. I mean, this gigantic tree was like 5 foot across, with giant spikes coming off the bottom. I thought it was a different variety, and turns out they're all the exact same genetic plant. But if you grow it up in, you know, like 9 to 10,000 feet, it grows like a creeping vine, and it has the same flowers, same beans, same everything, and you can move it around. So the Mayan idea was this was time in different environments took on a different shape. Can you imagine? Wow.
Oh, it sounds like a story of tenacity. Tenacity,
it is.
Yes.
I'm telling you what that is.
Oh,
well, you read the part about I'm trying to blow the tree up, these fools, you know.
Yeah.
So crazy.
I want to remind everyone that you are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Radio 89.1. Donna Lana Kitchen is tasty community radio for the heart of Iowa.
Swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukino
some music by a couple of musicians and some other musician friends. They come through Ames every now and then. They're called Four Shillings Short, and they're a wonderful, they're just the quintessential traveling couple that does all kinds of music. He's from Ireland, she's from California, and they've spent time all over the world learning things. That was a little chant from India, and she plays a dandy sitar along with all the other instruments that travel with them, too. So we are in the kitchen here on Donna Lana Kitchen with Martine Prechtel. Donna has a cooking question for Martine.
Yeah, Martine is okay. Is going to be here next week talking about his book. He will be at the library, the Ames Public Library, on Tuesday, October 27th, 7 p.m. And Lana and I will be in the front row because we want to hear more of this. But Martine has mentioned that he grows his own special corn and grains And, Martine, how do you harvest it? Do you slake it with lime, or do you just grind it into – how do you eat it? How do you process what you grow?
Well, I never call it it because she's so alive to me. She's a her. So, first thing, all of the above. It depends on what you're making. There's a, you know, my whole life is corn. The Pueblo people, all their life is corn. So you can eat the corn green, like, you know, everybody does when they're calling sweet corn, which mm-hmm. is called, you know, like elote, and there's various forms of ways of doing that. Then you can take it a little bit later stage when it's still not out of milk, and you cook those in great big mud ovens or down in a hole till you can hear it exploding down there. And then you pull it out and you dry that in the air, and you use those in the winter for mixing with deer meat or any kind of sheep meat or and all the sorts of chilies.
Is it like popcorn?
You know, New Mexicans are chili eaters, you know. What's yeah. that?
Is it like popcorn kind of then? When
No. This is chilaquiles. You can do it with pretty much any corn. You can do it with sweet corn, too, but for me, it's too sweet. It doesn't really got the zap.
So it's like a dry roasting process?
No. You roast it just like you would sweet corn if you're going to eat it on the ears, but you don't eat it, and then you dry that in the sun.
Oh.
And that turns into hard, you know, unplantable. They're no longer plantable because,
right.
of course, the germs have been killed.
Uh-huh.
But it preserves that early stage of flavor. So then when you go to rehydrate it in the winter, it's one of the major, you know, New Mexico and south of the border type foods called chicales or chicos, sometimes they call them. And you mix that with your dried meat, which you've rehydrated as well, and mix that with the different chilies and stuff that you have dried, green and red, and bring it up in the winter, and it's just amazing. So that's another thing to do. And then after that, of course, you let it go to full fruition. But before it's totally dry, then you can make hulk. And hulk is a way where you take the corn when it's, you know, the husk is still green. Inside has already got its color, and it's pretty hard, but still a little bit humid. And you grind that up on stone. They got these stone grinders, you know, and grind that up into like a mush. It's kind of like a paste. And then you mix that, and you take a few of the corn silks, and you put that on the back like you would on a cookie baking sheet with flour.
Uh-huh.
And you throw that on a really hot griddle, and you make them in triangular shape, and they mix like basically a pancake. And that's so sweet, and the kids, you know, just love it because, well, I do. I mean, it's very crunchy on one side, and you can put different honeys and things. And I put goat milk on mine. And then another thing, this is what I eat every day, is that you take this particular type of corn is basically a flour flint. It's not just one or the other. It's wonderfully versatile.
Mm-hmm.
And you take that and you
and is it the white or the blue?
Both.
Oh,
both.
Okay.
Both. They have different characters, but they're both. Then you take and you dry this in the fall. You let it take one frost and you dry it for a month or two outside, and then you got to bring it inside in some sort of place. And you get it really, really good and dry. And so I keep those all year. Always leave them on the cobs. You never take them off the cobs.
Yes.
You take them off the cobs, you start losing stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then just before you're going to eat, you know, like I take off enough for about 6 days. And then every morning, well, you have toasted it. You take it and you toast it like a parched corn. And then you grind that into flour. Then you mix that into, like you would be if you're going to make polenta, but thinner. And then you cook that in the morning, and you drink that. Some people put, Indians in the South put chocolate, ground chocolate beans. And then other people put beans. They take, you know, this kind of giant beans. I forget what you call them in English. They call them piloy. But they're big red beans, and they put those in with salt, and they drink that and eat that as a kind of a mush. Around here, that's called chiquewe, or in the tribe where I grew up, it's called huchate.
So it's salted rather than sweetened?
No, definitely not sweetened. It's definitely a savory.
Uh-huh.
And then if you do that, same thing, but you put less water in, then you start to make little balls. Then you make like these little tiny balls, and then you roll them around in a pan with a tallow from a deer's back. And then they start, supposedly that's the original thing. I don't know. That's what the legends say. And then you pull those out, and then you have a big, it's really beautiful, these little balls of corn balls. And then those are eaten with chili stews, which are not, you know, in New Mexico and in south of the border, chili is not a spice. It's a food. You know, it's like you eat a lot of chili. And we eat like 400 or 500 pounds just
yeah, they're pepper plants.
Yeah, we eat the whole thing. We don't, like, you know, put a little, like, salt and pepper, you know. We eat chili, man.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a hard thing to explain to me.
It's a major vegetable.
It is a major vegetable,
yes.
Major food. But anyway, now, okay, so those are the straight corn. Now, when you're talking about using lime or ashes, Then you take the same corn once it's dry and you cook with a certain amount of lime. Everybody's got their recipe the night before. Then you let it set all night. Then in the morning, you know, you wash it and strain off all the husks. Mm-hmm. And then you can grind that into a masa. Or you can clear all that off and then make a pozole, which is, basically mm-hmm. what the East Coast people call hominy, mm-hmm. but it's a slightly different method. And then with that is put in all kinds of things. We use that for everything like that. And then your normal so-called tortilla is, of course, that ground up mm-hmm. and then done on a really hot griddle with a certain amount of technique without them. I don't really like the ones that are pressed out because they get kind of leathery. But the ones made by hand, you can't beat them. I mean, man, one side is, you can tell it's lunchtime here. I'm starting to get hungry. it starts fluffing up on one side. And all the Indian, they're very particular about it. One side fluffing up and makes like a big old balloon. When you take them out, you have to put them in the basket just right. And when you eat them, you always turn the face away from you so that the tortilla doesn't feel pain when you bite in. Oh. So they have all these rules about seeds and food, you know, because mm-hmm. it's all very much alive.
Oh, it sounds like a wonderful way. So many different
ways. Anyway, I can
ways.
Go on and on about recipes, but there's thousands of things.
Oh,
and all kinds
wonderful.
Of pulikes. We just made a huge feast here for about 300 people. We ground up 95 pounds of the blue and about 100 pounds of the white, and we made subang, which is actually made in the summer by taking doing ashes on half of it and then dried on the other half, mixing them together, and then you put those in the actual corn leaves, not the corn husks, but the actual fronds that come off the stalk, and then you bend those in little squares, and so you steam those in these giant pots on the fire. And then when you pull those out, you just hold one leaf, and it goes blip, 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 like one of those little Chinese puzzles, you know.
Oh.
And out rolls this little flat corn cake, which has a ridge in the middle, which is called the road of the sun. And it breaks right in half to two equal parts, and you put that in your birria, and you're styling.
Oh, there seems like so much to do and so much to taste.
It's really good. Yeah,
we're unfortunately sort of running out of time here, but I want to mention that... Yes, come and hear Martine next week at the public library. Martine Prechtel has been our guest today. Thank you for being with us, Martine. This is absolutely fantastic.
I'm sorry, I'm so talkative. You know, I had an Irish grandmother on one side and a Cree on the other, and you combine them and makes a really noisy fella.
Hey, this.
But I also want to say to congratulate you on what you're doing, because it's so beautiful to see Lana and Donna on a show like this in the world. And one of these great and radio stations that are still doing independent stuff, because that's what I love to support if I can.
Well, thank
and
you,
I'm just
Martin.
Really impressed, so thank you.
Martin, when you come to Iowa, will you be coming with a little bit of your corn?
If you want me to, I'll bring it.
Oh, we'd love to taste it.
I'll bring it. Yeah, okay. Well, I don't go without it. I mean, if I don't eat my corn in 4 days, I start feeling like something's wrong. You know?
Oh, well, bring a little for us to try.
Oh,
I'll
that'd be
some.
Lovely. Looking forward
some.
To meeting
I'll
you.
I'll bring some seeds to you if you promise to plant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, great, great. You've been
all
listening.
All blessings.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you, Martine.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen with special guest Martine Prechtel. He's an author, a philosopher. He does a lot of things very well. Come and hear him speak. And his latest book is called The Smell of Rain on Dust. He will be at the library next week here in Ames. Donalana Kitchen is a radio program produced here at KHOI Radio. We are on Tuesdays at noon. We're repeated Tuesdays at 7 p.m. in the evening, or anytime you can get repeats and downloads at khoifm.org, support community radio station. We've heard the music of Four Shillings Short. Contact us at this radio station. Tell us what's on your plate. khoiradio@gmail.org. We'd love to hear from you. My name's Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering, as usual, by Rick Morrison. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Circus Kill.